Hey, everybody. Welcome to the very first 100 Huntley Street podcast. This is Cheryl Weber with Mark Masery, Laura Woo-hoo! Watson. Yay! We're just missing Greg Musselman from Alberta.
Yes,
but
we are.
How excited are we to finally be able to get to do podcasts?
Oh, I am so excited. I'm just like pumped. And you know what? This is going to be too much fun, maybe. I don't know. Are we going to get carried away?
We could get carried away. It might become a little addictive. Three of us behind microphones with way more talk time than we get on the program. Oh. No, I'm just kidding. We're not going to bore you for too long, but we've got some exciting programs lined up for you this season. And Laura, today for show one, you've got like one of your favorite authors of all times, like since university days.
That's right. That's right. Mitch Albom, he wrote Tuesdays with Maury, The Five People You Meet in Heaven. He's sold 450 million books. And, you know, I just love his writing. And he's going to be talking to us about his new book today, The Stranger in the Lifeboat.
Mm. Who's the stranger?
Right, who's the stranger? Okay, what I love about this conversation is if you have ever had a moment in your life where something's gone wrong, like in your life, and you don't understand, like, where is God? You prayed for something, the opposite happened, you're suffering. Maybe you don't even believe in God. And I love this because this is so true about us humans, right? You don't believe in God, but in that moment, you're like, God, help. If you help me, I'll promise I'll stop doing this or I'll do this better. I'll be nicer, whatever, right? Have you guys ever known that?
100%.
Right? I've done that.
I mean, this interview is going to tackle some of those perceptions of God, maybe some of the boxes that we put him in or those constructs that we build up of God. Just can't wait, you know, for you all to hear this conversation. Laura, really, really super excited. In fact, in just a second, we are going to go to that interview with Laura and Mitch Albom. Stay with us.
We often call on God in times of great distress, but what if one of those times we called on him, he actually appeared? New York Times bestselling author Mitch Albom, known for books that help bridge the gap between heaven and earth, explores this idea in his latest work, The Stranger in the Lifeboat. Welcome to 100 Huntley Street, Mitch.
Thanks for having me on the show.
That's our pleasure. Mitch, your books such as Tuesdays with Maury and The Five People You Meet in Heaven have sold over 450 million copies worldwide. In broad strokes, can you tell our viewers about the story plot of your latest book, The Stranger in the Lifeboat?
Sure. So the 30-second movie pitch kind of goes like this. There's this very rich luxury yacht out in the middle of the ocean, lots of famous rich people on it. Inexplicably, it suddenly blows up. Everybody is killed except 10 people, five of whom are the rich guests, five of whom are crew members. They find their way to a life raft. They're out there for 3 days and nobody is coming for them. There's no planes, no boats. They're running out of food, running out of water. They see sharks. They're scared. They're crying out for help. And suddenly they see this body floating in the water. They pull it into the boat and it's this young guy, very average looking, nondescript guy. They start peppering him with questions. He doesn't say anything. And finally, one of the passengers says, "Well, thank the Lord we found you." And he says, "I am the Lord." And it goes on from there.
Well, it's a riveting book and it's gripped, you know, the narrative communities as well as faith communities. And, you know, you shared that writing this book was a personal journey of healing for you. Can you tell us a bit about the inspiration behind this book?
Well, at its core, The Stranger in the Lifeboat is about seeking help. What happens when we ask for help? I've noticed that a lot of times we ask for help from God, we kind of expect it right then and there, like we're ordering a deli sandwich, and if it doesn't come exactly the way we look it or taste like exactly what we expected, we're disappointed somehow. We think we're not being listened to. Well, for me, I had gone through something 4 or 5 years earlier than I wrote this book with the death of a child that we had adopted. Her name was Chica. I run an orphanage in Haiti. I'm there every month and been there for 12 years. And she was one of our kids who we adopted when she developed a brain tumor. And she lived for 2 more years with us, my wife and I, but she died. I was quite upset when she died, very angry with God, as I guess you could understand. And I couldn't understand why God wouldn't answer our prayer to save her. And it really wasn't until a few years later when I sat down to write this book that I realized that we had made another prayer, my wife and I, earlier in our life, back when we got married, that we would have children. And we got married kind of late in life and it didn't happen. And at that time, we sort of figured, well, I guess that prayer is just not being answered. But then when I look back on it, I said, well, wait a minute. Maybe Chica's arrival in our life, even for a couple of years, was the answer to that prayer. It just, we didn't associate it with that because we were so busy making another prayer, like, let her live longer, let her stay with us longer. And so it got me thinking about how many times we ask for help and maybe get it, but don't recognize it because it's not exactly what we figured. And that's how the sort of personal and fictional came into one.
Yes, and you know, it's such an interesting journey throughout the book. One of the characters in the book is God. And I was thinking about, you know, what were some of the character traits that were really important for you to portray as you were portraying God?
Well, first of all, I don't want readers to think that I have any kind of insight into what God would say. I joke around that when I wrote that book, I was like on my keyboard here, like looking up like that constantly, hoping that a lightning bolt wouldn't come down and blow up my computer for the heresy of writing about what God would say. But also, I want to warn readers that it's not exactly, you've read the book, so it's not exactly what you think it is. Maybe this guy is God, maybe he isn't God. He just claims he's God and says a lot of things that are very God-like. So when you ask me what was important, it wasn't important in the way that I portrayed a godlike character in terms of what he looked like, what he sounded like. In point of fact, I tried to do exactly the opposite of what you would have thought. There was nothing regal about him. There was nothing royal. He didn't look like Gandalf from Lord of the Rings. Or, you know, he was kind of an average-looking schlub, you know. He got tired a lot. He got hungry a lot. He fell asleep a lot. And you know, it's like that song, What If God Were One of Us, you know, just trying to find his way home. You know, we always have these visions of what God would look like, separate from Jesus, of course. And I thought it was important to focus on what God said and the messages, and to almost set that against the backdrop of the person who's saying it doesn't look like what you think, because you have to have the faith that looks don't matter. You know, when God spoke to Moses in a bush, Moses didn't say, well, you can't be God, that's a bush. He trembled with the fear of God because he knew it was God speaking through this burning bush. And so I tried to keep that kind of idea in mind.
So interesting. And I did notice how relatable the character of God was in the book throughout the development of that character in different ways. You know, one of the things that I find really interesting, you know, about the book is the way that you traverse the themes of doubt and faith. Like, some of the people in the book are going between intense doubt and then actually experiencing faith. Why was that important for you to showcase that tension?
Because I think that's how we all are in this world. I think we walk lines. Even those of us who call ourselves believers or faithful have moments of doubt and have moments where we're not sure. And if you're really God, God, then do this, do that. And so there were many moments where they kind of confront God with that kind of thing. For example, there's something bad happens to one of the people on the boat, and another person, another survivor, turns to this God character and says, how could you have let that happen? You know, if you were really God, you would have stopped that. And the God character says, God starts things, man stops them. And it was an important lesson to try to get across, because how many times do we say, well, why didn't God stop this bad thing from happening? Why didn't God stop that war from happening? Why didn't God stop that person from shooting that person? And when you really think about it, it's like, well, wait a minute, God didn't make the guns. God didn't make the wars. God didn't make the cigarettes. God didn't make the cancer-causing agents. God didn't make a lot of that stuff. We did. I'm one of those people who believes that God gave us everything we need on this earth to make a paradise if we choose to do so. We could cure hunger like that if we wanted to. We have all the means. We could probably cure every disease there is out there. Look at what we did in 1 year with COVID when we really put our minds to it. Don't you think if we really put a global effort like that to cancer that we could cure that and other things? So I think we have everything we need, but we frequently blame God when things don't go our way. And of course, never give God credit when things do. We like to pat ourselves on the back when things go the way. So those kinds of earthly sort of lessons I thought were important to put into the characters as they were relating to him, as they're trying to survive on a life raft with sharks and heat and running out of food and all those things that really test your faith, you know, because you don't know how much longer you're going to be able to hold out.
And, you know, your main character, one of your main characters, Benji, you know, he reflects on his life and he says, God has been a stranger to me. I'm paraphrasing that, but God feels like a stranger. Do you think some of our misunderstandings of what's happening, how we're experiencing, whether our prayers are answered or not, you know, what we're seeing in the world around us, why isn't God solving that? Is that what leads us to feel like God's a stranger to some of us?
Absolutely. When we feel like our life isn't going the way we want it to, we feel that therefore God can't be on our side. When we have bad opinions of ourselves, when we have self-doubt, we feel God must not be on our side. There's a line between Benji and this character of God where he says, if I were you, Benji says, I would have given up on me a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And the God character says, but you're not me, and I never will. And there's a difference between, you know, the tolerance that we expect from other human beings for us and the tolerance that we have a right to expect from God for us, which is interminable. It will never end. And there's a moment where Benji, who is racked by the death of his wife, and to me, this is kind of the center point of the book, and this is really where my personal life became intertwined with the book. He has this confrontation with God towards the end of the book, and many, many people since the book has come out, and so many people have read it now around the world, they've written to me about this page of the book, page 241. I know because they all write 241, page 241. It's where Benji says to him, why did my wife have to die? Why did you take my wife? Which is the question that we always ask God, right, when somebody dies, you know, why? And the answer that comes back is, why is it that when someone dies on this earth, human beings are always saying, why did God take them? Maybe a better question would be, why did God give them to us? What did we do to deserve their love, their sweetness, the memories that they made with us? Didn't you have that with your wife? And he says, I had it every day. And God says, well, those memories are a gift, but their absence is not a punishment. I'm not cruel. I don't take people from you so I can watch you suffer. I know you before you're born. I know you after you die. This earth is just part of the story. I know you cry for those who have left you behind, but I can assure you, they're not crying. And I wrote that page as much for me as I did for anybody who reads the book. I wrote it because that's how I feel about our little girl, that at the beginning, I couldn't understand why she was taken by God. But in the end, I realized she was given to us. She was a gift. We were in our mid late 50s. And we suddenly got the gift of having a child in our lives, sleeping in our bed, waking us up for breakfast, giggling, you know, putting her hand over my mouth when I tried to sing with her, all the funny little memories that you have of a child that changed your life. And we got this so late in life, that was a gift. That was given to us. And if you start to look at things as like, well, what did I do to deserve the gift I had, as opposed to what did I do wrong to have it taken from me, then your life is much more about gratitude than it is about grumbling and being angry. And I would much rather live in the former than the latter.
Such profound words. And, you know, that part of your book really struck me as well. It helped me see loss differently, loss of people that, you know, we love. Mitch, another interesting piece of your book I noticed was, you know, we're often waiting to hear from God. And you know, so we want God to move in those ways and speak to us. But I noticed the character of God throughout your book listened a lot. There was a big theme of God listening. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Well, yeah, I think we all expect God, because our concepts from the movies or from books or whatever is God comes down and declares. But for me, the core of understanding is always about listening. And so when God first shows up, and none of these people in the boat believe he is who he says he is, and they say, well, what are you doing here? If you're God, what are you doing in this boat? And he says, well, weren't you calling for me? You were calling out. You were saying, God, help us. So I came. And that's such the concept of that, just that blows their mind, that God would actually listen to something that we said. And there's another part where one of the people says to him, well, if you're God, do you answer every prayer? And he says, I answer every prayer, but sometimes the answer is no. And again, that's about listening. Mm-hmm. We think when our prayers aren't answered, that means God didn't listen to us. Well, maybe God listened to us all the time, but can't grant that particular wish or desire, maybe because to grant it would mean to take away from somebody else. Mm-hmm. I worked as a sports writer for many years of my life, and I always found it amusing when I go into the locker room and one team would say, well, God, you know, thank God for this one. God wanted us to win this game. And I always said, well, did God want the other team to lose the game then? What are they saying over there? That God forsook us, you know, or forsaked us, or whatever the past tense of forsake is. So, you know, sometimes our wishes and our prayers run contrary to other things that God wants to have happen in the world. But that doesn't mean that God isn't listening. I think God is always listening. And I try to get that across mm-hmm. in the characters who claim to be God in this book.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it does come across. You know, for some of the other characters in the book who journey from places of doubt to places of faith, what would you say that narrative journey is like for them and in terms of where they end up personally?
Well, I tried to do a whole spectrum of characters in the boat. So there's some, like one of the richest men in the world. He never really accepts anything. He keeps thinking his money is going to save him. And so he constantly mocks the God character and says, you know, you're a joke and, you know, you're not going to save me. My money is going to save me. There are other people who don't believe at the beginning, but then come to change their mind and are at peace with what happens to them once they do. And then Benji's journey is really the journey that we follow. And he's sort of the surrogate for me, surrogate for most people, in that he starts out thinking that he's worthless, thinking that because he couldn't save his wife from dying, he has no meaning in his own life, and that he must have deserved the bad fate that he got. And there's even a character who finds, he's a police inspector, and a year after all this is happening, he finds the raft washed up on shore, empty, but finds a notebook inside of it that is actually telling the story. And his life changes as a result of reading the story about there being God in this lifeboat. And it was someone who lost a child like me, and then comes to feel that there's no such thing as God. The world's a joke. He drinks. He kind of falls down the ladder of life, and then discovers this notebook and starts reading about this character who claimed to be God. And ultimately has his faith changed too, just by the fact that there could be such a thing that happened out on this life raft, a miracle that happened on this life raft. So I tried to, there's 10 people represented in the book, plus the police captain, and they're all on their own little paths or journeys, as you call it. And I think that's kind of typical of the world. You know, if you got 10 people together and said, okay, what's your faith journey? I'm pretty sure they wouldn't all be the same. There'd be some who were, I don't have one. There'd be some who say my faith is stronger than a rock. Go ahead and test me. And there'd be people in the middle who say, well, I am quite not sure where I stand. And I thought that would be a pretty good representation in the boat.
Well, speaking of faith journeys, Mitch, you were raised Jewish and you have deeper friendships with, you've had deep friendships with both rabbis as well as pastors, and the orphanage you run in Haiti, Have Faith Haiti. You know, you do devotionals at night there with the kids. I wanted to ask you, as someone who understands probably both worlds of the Old Testament and the New Testament, what are some of the similarities you see between the two?
I see nothing but similarities between the two. I see very few conflicts between the two in terms of the idea of what faith is supposed to be. Love, caring for one another, taking care of what Christians generally refer to the least of these, and Jewish people will call the tikkun olam, which is, you know, saving the world and goodness for the sake of the world. It's the same thing. It's taking care of those who don't have the means. It's taking care of the widows and the orphans. It's taking care of children in the world. It's watching out and being a decent person, not because you're worried about whether you go to heaven or hell, but because it's the right thing to do to be a decent person. And so, you know, you're right to say, you know, I kind of traverse between two worlds. I was raised Jewish. My wife is Christian and very devout. The orphanage that we run is a Christian orphanage and a Christian mission. I wrote a book called Have a Little Faith, which was literally about a 90-something-year-old rabbi and an African-American pastor who had a church that had a hole in its roof where snow actually came in on top of the congregants. They were all homeless and poor congregants, and they would pray through the snow. And I studied these two men and spent an inordinate amount of time with both of them, years, and saw enormous similarities between the two of them. And I remember asking this rabbi one time, because he was a big cheerleader for other faiths. He admired other faiths. He talked about them all the time. And I said, isn't that kind of like not in your job description? Aren't you supposed to say like ours is right and everybody else is wrong? And you know, because you're a leading figure in it. And he said, well, I don't look at it that way, Mitch. He said, look at trees. And I said, okay, what do you mean? He said, well, did God make trees? And I said, yes. And he said, well, why did God make trees? God's God. Why did God need to make more than one tree? If God makes a tree, it's a perfect tree because God made the tree. Mm-hmm. He could have populated the whole world with one tree and it would have been beautiful. But instead, we have the oak and the pine and the elk and the spruce and all the rest of that stuff. Why? He said, well, maybe faiths are the same way. All of these different kind of trees, all kind of growing up, branching out towards the heavens, reaching up to God, but God-like just the same, and all in the end kind of leading to the same place. And I thought, you know, this is a much healthier attitude to have in a world of multiple religions and multiple faiths than it is to go through life saying, we're right, they're wrong, they need to die, you know, we need to live. I don't think that's God-like at all, no matter what your faith is. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of lived in that path, and I find that all faiths, as long as they're practiced honestly and truly and have the benefit of mankind at their core and not the benefit of an individual, because anybody could create a religion. You know, I could create the religion of Mitch. You know, that doesn't make it a faith. But when you have the benefit of the world and making, you know, taking care of other people as your core, then I respect all faiths. And I've learned from all of them. I've moved through all of them. I've written stories that have been accepted by all of them, with much to my really pleasure, you know, that books like The Five People You Meet in Heaven have been embraced in Catholic churches, Christian organizations, Jewish faiths, Islamic communities, because the idea of finding that in heaven that our lives matter is not dogmatic. It doesn't belong to one faith. And I try to concentrate on ideas that kind of are like that spread out to all different faiths.
Yeah, so insightful. Thank you. Mitch, before we go here, you know, you've mentioned your daughter Chica and her story, and I was wondering if you could just tell us a bit more about the memoir you wrote on her behalf, Finding Chica, A Little Girl, An Earthquake, and the Making of a Family.
So Chica was born 3 days before the terrible earthquake in 2010. She actually survived it when she was 3 days old, when her house collapsed around her, but the roof fell backwards. And so the walls just fell down and she was on the bed with her mother and she lived miraculously. She was 3 days old. That night they put her in a bed of sugarcane leaves and she slept out in the dirt for the next 6 weeks of her life. So she was born tough. And she needed to be tough. Her mother died 2 years later, giving birth to a baby brother. She became an orphan. She was brought to the orphanage that I operate in Haiti. For several years, she was our loudest, youngest, brashest, boldest kid that we had. She told everybody else where they could go, who they could play with, what ball they could use, everything. And we just said, well, that's Chica. You know, you could hear her voice like from across the yard. And then when she was five, she developed a brain tumor, something called DIPG, which is kind of a four-letter word for death. And we brought her to America, hoping that the American surgeons would be able to get it out, and then she could go back to Haiti and resume her life. But she never went home. She ended up becoming our little girl, our daughter, and we had adopted her and took her all around the world for the next. She was supposed to live for 4 months, they said. That's it. She'll be here for 4 months and gone. She lived for 2 years. And during those 2 years, we traveled around the world searching for a cure. And while we weren't able to find a cure in the end, we did find something equally precious, and that is a family. And we learned so much about what it means to have a family, what makes a family. And it doesn't, you know, children don't have to look like you, talk like you, act like you, speak the same language as you, have the same DNA as you. But we could not have loved Chica any more than if she was a spitting image of the two of us. And the joy that she gave us, her joie de vivre, she was always upbeat. She was always laughing. She never really knew what was going on with her. She went to doctors, but, you know, we let her be a child. And she really thrived in being a child. And she taught me so many things about love, about my marriage, about a sense of wonder that children have, about time, you know, and how really when you know, the most precious thing that you can give to someone is your time, because you can never get it back. And when you give it to a child, you're giving it in the best possible way, because you're developing another human being to grow up in the world who can then one day give it to someone else. And Chica, I'll end with this one little anecdote that Chica taught. I mean, like I say, she taught me so much in so many little ways. But one time towards the end of her life, when she couldn't walk, I had to carry her from place to place. That was my job, you know. And, you know, I was her taxi service. I have to take her to the bathroom and take her to the car, take her wherever, because she couldn't walk. And she was fine with that. She loved that, you know. She loved having me around like that. And we were sitting coloring one day, and she said, I looked at my watch. I popped up. I said, Chica, I got to go. I'm late for work. And she said, no, Mr. Mitch, sit, stay and color. I said, no, Chica, don't you understand? I have to work. And she said, Mr. Mitch, I have to play. And I said, well, it's not the same thing, because this is my job. And she crossed her arms, you know, like she would do, and made a little face. And she said, no, it isn't. Your job is carrying me. And, you know, after I laughed, which she always made me laugh, then I realized, wow, what a profound sentence. Of course, my job is carrying her. And all of our jobs is to carry our children, you know, through sickness, through health. And if you're blessed, as I have been blessed, and you have the means, then it's our jobs to carry the sick and forgotten children of the world, which is what we try to do with this orphanage. We have 55 children there we raise, from ages 1 all the way up to 19. They go through school there. We get them college scholarships. They come back and work at the orphanage and then go into Haiti and make their country a better place. That's our responsibility. That is what we carry. What you put in your arms and walk around with in your life is who you are. And for many years in my life, what I walked around with was my work and my books and my accomplishments and my money and all that stuff. And then all of a sudden I had to drop all that, because I had to carry a 5 and 6 and 7 year old girl around because she couldn't walk. And there was no comparison between those two tasks. You know, it was the biggest honor I had, was to carry her around in my life. And I retain that honor now with the other children. Her brother and her sister are both at our orphanage now. Her little baby brother, who was born when her mother died, and her older sister are now with us, and we carry them. And that's what I learned from her, what a privilege it is to have children in your life.
Well, Mitch, I think Chica is still teaching a lot of us through what you're sharing. Mitch, I just want to thank you so much for inspiring so many to consider God and faith and hope. Thank you for being with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Wow, great conversation with Mitch, Lara. You know, one thing that I want to pull out of that interview, he says, we often expect help from God to come instantaneously. If not, we think he's not listening. You know, I mean, how many times have I been guilty of that?
Oh, yeah. Oh.
And is God truly not listening? We know. Absolutely yes. Not. He is always listening.
Mm. And he always, like, pretty much in my mind, takes longer than I wish he would. Like, I don't know, his sense of timing. I mean, think about this. Jesus said he was coming back soon.
Yeah.
And it's been 2,000 years.
Yeah. I always say God is rarely early, but he's never late.
Oh, wisdom from Mark Massery.
I really Lara, what you pulled out with Mitch about that whole idea. Like, we say, God, why did you take that person from me?
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, thank you, God, that you gave me that person. Instead of being grateful, mm-hmm. right? We're accusatory. Like, we're all going to die. So we're all going to lose somebody at some point in our lives. We just don't know when that is. And it's so funny, because I've been thinking about this in my own life, about how sometimes even people in my life can get me to focus on the things I don't have. Like, you know, you sacrificed this, or you did that, or you don't have this or whatever.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, I need to keep shifting my mind away from what they're saying to me to be like, God, thank you for what I do have.
Yes.
I have so much more than maybe someone else that I know that's going through a really hard time, that maybe just lost somebody, or, you know, and just to be thankful for breath every day that I am alive.
Yes.
I think that shifts everything in your life when you have that perspective.
Oh, I think that's so true. You know, starting with gratitude in every area of our lives. And sometimes it's just the reminder. I actually think it's interesting too. Sometimes we forget to have gratitude, but if we just even kind of force ourselves to verbalize it.
Yes.
Thank you for my breath today. Thank you for my family. Thank you for the loved one I got to spend 15 years with. Thank you for these opportunities in my life. That glass half full perspective, we know it changes our our minds, our hearts, and our well-being, like how we're doing. But, you know, sometimes we need someone to walk alongside us and remind us of those things to, you know, be grateful for, or even help us to see them, because we can be feeling so, you know, dark and in despair. And, you know, that's what I love about our prayer lines and our prayer partners. We can always call, people can call them and get support and, you know, get a little bit of a cheer up. Like, you know, what has God done in your life? What can God do in your life?
Yeah. Yeah. And we hear stories all the time of how those prayer partners shifts people's perspectives.
Oh yeah. And to your point, Cheryl, for some scripture to back up what you're just saying, you know, talking about not being anxious for anything, but in everything in prayer, by prayer and petition with Thanksgiving. Always change your focus to with Thanksgiving. In fact, I was praying today, like there's this business transaction that I'm working on. It's been a little bit frustrating. It looks like it's going to happen and then it's not going to happen, back and forth. I'm just like, God, I'm going to change my whole focus on this prayer. I'm going to thank you for whatever you determine as the answer in advance. Forget about the obstacles. Get my eyes off of those things and keep my eyes on you. And it kind of ties into something else that Mitch said in your conversation. Sometimes our prayers run contrary to what God really wants to happen. So, hey, maybe we need to be asking our changing our prayers to say, God, whatever you want in this situation, your will be done, not mine.
And it all comes back into trusting his goodness and his heart for us. Oh, there's so much more we could unpack. Yes. We are out of time. You have been listening to the very first 100 Huntley Street podcast.
This is it.
Mark Masery, Laura Watson, Cheryl Weber. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a fantastic rest of your day.
Thank you for your ongoing support of Crossroads, a supporter-funded nonprofit organization and member of the Canadian Centre of Christian Charities. Thanks to faithful people like you, we are able to continue producing 100 Huntley Street. You can write to Crossroads, P.O. Box 5100, Burlington, Ontario, L7R4M2, or visit crossroads.ca to learn more about our programs.